Everybody, Chris Webster here to talk about one of the latest supporters to the Archaeology Podcast Network, The Motley Fool. Now, I've been investing in the stock market through various applications for a few years now, and everybody who's listening to this can benefit from that sort of investment for the long-term financial planning. And also, I know the hosts of these podcasts can benefit because as archaeologists, like none of us get retirement, we all have to kind of fend for ourselves. So investing in the stock market is a good idea, but not everybody can do it. And look, we get it. The market is complicated and confusing, and to many of us, it simply doesn't make sense. In fact, where do you even start? Take all of the guesswork out of it with The Motley Fool Stock Advisor. The Motley Fool has been around for over 25 years and has been spot on in recommending some of the world's most important companies before they hit the big time. I'm talking about Amazon, Tesla, Netflix, Starbucks, all before they exploded in value. With their easy to use and super informative service, Stock Advisor, you could join the ranks before they potentially find the next big thing. After all, their average stock recommendation is up over 400% as of April 10th, 2023. And no need to be intimidated by financial jargon or market complexities. As the name suggests, these guys don't take themselves too seriously. Now, finances, that's a different story. Their friendly and relaxed approach has helped over 700,000 people move closer to financial independence, all while beating the market and having fun. New members can access Stock Advisor for only $89 for their first year, a full $110 off the full list price. Don't sit on the sidelines and think about what could have happened. Visit fool.com/APN to start your investing journey today. That's $110 discount off of $199 per year list price. Membership will renew annually at the then current list price. So again, check the link in the show notes of this episode.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 261.
On today's show, we talk about Jewish art, Italian art, and Peruvian art.
Let's dig a little deeper, but don't knock any more frescoes off the wall. Tesseract. Welcome to the show, everyone. Rachel.
It's going great.
I start the show exactly the same way I do Archaeotech, except Paul doesn't give me any crap.
Oh, well, but I'm me, so like my job is to give you crap.
Wow.
Come on. You're like looking at the ocean right now, so I don't feel that bad for you. So
I am indeed.
Yeah.
And it feels like we're in Oregon or Washington, really Oregon, the Washington coast, unless you get up really north on the peninsula, doesn't really look like this, but all of Oregon looks like this. But we're in Northern California.
Yeah. Like we're really close to Redwoods National Park and it's like a little rainforest here.
Yeah.
It's such a cool part of the country.
Yeah.
And you know, us, we're always trying to find like cheap places to spend a night on the way when we're in transit somewhere. And right now we're on our way to your parents' house in Florence, Oregon. But this casino that we're parked at in their parking lot is a really cool deal. It's a great little spot to park, and somehow magically we have a view of the ocean from our RV, which you can't get.
Yeah.
At an RV park for less than like $100 a night. And it was $20 for three nights here. What?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of through the trees and across the parking lot.
I know. Like it's not fantastic or anything, but like there it is.
I know.
You know, I'm always chasing the view. So
I know. And we're actually on Native American land too. We're on the Trinidad Rancheria.
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. It's funny when you travel around a lot, and other archaeologists would know this as well. Sometimes you just forget where you've been. Like we drove down into the little harbor area, just kind of looking for this restaurant to grab some lunch when we got here. And the minute we got around the corner and I saw this like this big peninsula kind of thing, this big rock and then the little harbor, I was like, oh, yep, we've been here.
We've been here. And then he pulled up on his phone like, did you do it by location?
I did it by search. I searched Trinidad.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And it just came up with the photos that we took when we were here last time, because we did some photos for some of my knitting designs. So,
I know if you haven't actually tried this, I know on iPhone, it's just in the Photos app, and on Google, I know Google does this. They've been doing it for a while. Mm-hmm. But if you just search something, it'll search in the photo. It'll search the location of the photo.
It's so good.
It's actually super great. Like I remember one time we needed the license plate for the RV, and I knew I'd taken a picture of it, and I searched license plate and I found all these pictures I didn't even know had license plates in them.
Yes.
Because like I've just taken a
random
picture.
Random cars that were like in the shot.
Yeah.
But it also brought up the license plate too. So search has gotten really, really great in photos.
I know. You know who else is searching for a photo? Archaeologists.
Wow.
And they found a photo of ancient Jewish life, kind of.
A photo?
Yeah.
Would we say that's a photo?
I mean, it's an old style photograph. And you really got to sit a while for it.
Oh my gosh.
It's not. Yeah, it's not at all.
No.
So this article is actually in National Geographic, and we have Apple News Plus, which gets us magazine subscriptions, one of which is National Geographic, mm-hmm. which is a pretty good deal, by the way, if you're an Apple user. I mean, I'm not trying to, we get no compensation from Apple for saying this.
God, not at all. Apple doesn't even know we exist, I don't think.
But we're also like Apple Power users, and for $30 a month on the family plan, we get Apple News Plus, we get extra storage for everything, we get Apple Fitness, we get Apple TV, and we get a bunch of other things. So, but I think it's like $4 or $5 a month to get Apple News Plus, and you get a bunch of magazine subscriptions.
It's really nice, because I mean, otherwise I wouldn't have National Geographic. Yeah. I'm not going to, we don't have space for actual paper magazines anymore. No. I'm not even sure who really does at this point. Yeah. So having the digital version of it is nice. But what that means is that when you go search for this article just on their website, it doesn't come up. And I don't know if they released the digital versions of the published in print articles later on or something like that. I don't know. But I definitely couldn't find it digitally except on Apple TV Plus as part of the issue. So all that being said, let's get to what the article is.
So they called it Surprising Scenes in Stone, and then it's subtitled Recently Completed Excavations of a Roman Era Synagogue Reveal Elaborate Mosaics and Upend Long-Held Beliefs About Ancient Jewish Life. And I can't remember if we said this, but it's the April 2024 issue.
Yes.
Yeah. So if you're looking for this.
Yeah.
But anyway, it is the site of Hukok, an ancient Jewish village, and it's located in a hilltop in northeastern Israel overlooking the Sea of Galilee. And they say the excavations began in 2010, and here's where we'll make an apology, because the excavations weren't really done to a high archaeological standard because of...
Okay, excuse me. Do not be throwing shade on somebody you don't even know, but her name is Jody Magnus, and she went to UNC Chapel Hill, my alma mater. That's why Chris is throwing shade right now. I have no idea who she is. She was there long after I was there, but that's fine. Anyway,
she's probably a professor there or something like that.
Probably.
And we're just like talking crap about her.
And like,
sorry, Jody.
And the department at Carolina was huge when I was there. And I don't think I even crossed paths with anybody who was working in that part of the world. My focus was all on South America and in Peru. So anyway, so Jody knew that this site was here because there were remains of stone buildings on the surface. And this is in 2010 when she first began, you know, looking into excavating it. She suspected there was more to be found below the surface. And that's why they started excavations, just like you would for any site where you know there's something under there. You just don't know what yet.
Most of the time we dig is because we know something is on we see something on the surface that indicates possibly something below.
And this is like a desert environment, right? So like, you know, they had these remains of walls and stuff there. They knew that there was something and you know, excavations began.
Yeah.
They uncovered a stone wall running north to south, approximately 7 feet below the surface. So that took a minute to get there, I'm sure.
Yeah, because I got to go down level by level.
Yep, level by level, because you never know what you're going to find.
Yep. There was a main door in the structure oriented towards Jerusalem, which was not uncommon if you had the ability to move the structure. I mean, if you're like in a town, that's not going to happen. But
right. And if you're a particular kind of structure, which in this case, because of the orientation, they are thinking that the structure was a synagogue. Mm-hmm. And they determined that it was approximately 1600 years old, and it was built sometime in the early 5th century CE.
Yeah.
So that's the time frame we're looking at here.
And synagogues of this time period that they found before typically have floors of paved flagstones. So like big rocks.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
They could be really nice big rocks.
Well, yeah, sure.
Yeah. And maybe there would be like a mosaic or two, but nothing crazy, right?
Yeah. Well, they continued excavating into the 2012 field season and began to find small little mosaic tiles known as tesserae. Now, that is not from the Marvel series,
the Tesseract.
But I'm sure the Tesseract would have been, you know, immortalized in tesserae at some point in time.
Yeah, the root words definitely come from the same place. Isn't tesserae like the coolest word ever,
though?
It is
pretty cool, yeah.
I love that word.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was new for me. Well, actually, it probably wasn't new for me because I did a whole mosaic thing in college, but it just came back to my memory that tesserae is a small mosaic tile.
Yeah.
And as they kept excavating down, they did eventually hit a floor, and that floor was revealed to be covered in elaborate mosaics.
Yeah.
And not like, you know, your basic mosaics, like elaborate. We'll talk about what the scenes were in a minute here.
Yeah, it took them. I mean, archaeology is not a quick science,
no.
Right? And a lot of times you're you're restricted in your field seasons by, I mean, usually the primary thing is funding and time. Like you're bringing students out there typically, and everybody has a limited amount of time that they can do this because it's costing them a lot of money, especially students are paying by the credit to be out there. So
and weather too, like you've got specific weather windows when you can really work also. So there's a lot of restrictions on how long a field season can be.
Right. And it took them 10 more excavation seasons, they say. Now, I'm assuming that's one season per year.
Yeah.
That's typically how that works, but it doesn't really elaborate on that.
That is what I understood.
Okay, yeah. And then they returned each time and continued uncovering the floor. Now, probably doing other stuff as
Probably
tasked a few people to just work on the floor and keep uncovering that, and then other people to do other stuff. That's just how excavations work.
Because you need more than just one thing. Like, the floor is great, but you need some context around that so that they could build the story of what this floor was, which I think they do have a pretty good story here. So,
now, here's something crazy. Well, this whole thing measures approximately 65 feet long by 50 feet wide, and the entire floor would have been covered in mosaic panels. Now, the picture at the top of the National Geographic article, until right now, and I've looked at this a couple times. I looked at it when we first put it in the card. I looked at it when we almost recorded last week, but didn't, and then just said we're traveling and then didn't release an episode.
Yeah.
Yep. Sorry, Bodhi.
Sorry
to our Australian friends. Uh-huh. But anyway, I'm looking at this picture again now, and I don't think I noticed the person in the upper right hand corner. I thought this was on a wall.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize how big it was and the person's for scale. I completely didn't realize that was a human, and I put them as part of something on the wall, some little thing. Like, and I can't believe how big this mosaic is.
Yeah, it's gigantic.
And this is just one of them.
One of the panels.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy how big it is.
Yeah.
So only about half the mosaics remain intact, but it is still so many more than a church or a synagogue of this of this time period usually would have. They would normally have like 1 to 3 mosaic panels, and they would be, you know, not of the quality that these mosaics are. So it is very special from that respect.
Yeah, these mosaics, being a synagogue and all, depict scenes from the Hebrew Bible, like pairs of animals heading towards Noah's Ark, the Red Sea engulfing the Egyptian army, the construction of the Tower of Babel, Samson carrying the gate of Gaza on his shoulder, Jonah being swallowed by 3 successively larger fish, which isn't like totally accurate, according to...
Well, yeah, I think it depends on the translation stories of the Bible that you're reading, because I always heard the whale, but that could have been because of a Christian thing. I don't know, but the picture is pretty hilarious of that one.
Oh, I know.
They have the whole if you scroll to the bottom of the article, you can see the whole thing, and it's like just a pair of legs like hanging out of the mouth of a smaller fish, and then there's inside of 2 more fish. It's pretty hilarious.
Yeah, there's also scenes from classical art, including Cupids, theater masks, and the Greek god of the sun, Helios.
Yeah, the context here is that the Romans conquered the land east of the Mediterranean, including Galilee, in the first century BCE. And at first, nothing much really changed for the Jewish people in this area. They lived as they had before. They had their own laws that were dictated by their religion. And they were given exemptions so that they didn't have to do things that they didn't want to do, such as worship the emperor, which is how the other Romans, that's what they would have done. They were worshiping their emperors at that time, basically.
And that all changed in the 4th century when Christianity became a legal religion, and they started to pass laws that restricted the freedoms the Jewish community had previously had.
Yeah, so Christianity takes over, and the first thing they do is start cracking down on the Jewish.
And then the Venetians came along. Wait, that's later.
Not yet. And not in this area, I don't think.
If you're new to the show, go listen to our episodes from Greece last fall. Right. Yeah.
So some of the things that the Christian laws did was banning the construction of synagogues. That was something that they often did.
Yeah.
But this synagogue was built during or after the time of these laws. So it's indicating that maybe like everyday enforcement of these rules weren't actually as strict as it might seem when you're just reading them in some kind of rule book somewhere, you know, that we still have. Just because the rule is on the books doesn't mean people are following it, basically. And this right here is a perfect example of that happening.
Yeah.
So back to the mosaics themselves. One of the panels is especially dazzling and also a little bit puzzling. And I wouldn't normally use the word puzzling because I'm so annoyed when archaeologists are puzzled in news articles. But I think this one actually does kind of fit the bill.
Also, mosaics are actually puzzles.
Oh, they kind of are. That's true. So this one is a little bit different. And the reason it's so dazzling, as they say, is the mosaic quality. Now, mosaic quality is measured in how many tesserae there are per square decimeter, which is about 15 square inches.
Right.
Most of the mosaics in this site range between 175 and 230 tesserae per square decimeter. But this one, this very special panel, is more than double at about 500 per square decimeter. That is so many tiny little mosaic stones.
That's more than the first Mario Brothers in the first Nintendo.
Like more pixels.
More pixels.
It's more pixels. Yeah.
They weren't working in 8-bit back then.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they could like truly draw actual artistic scenes when they had such small tesserae to work with.
I know. The scene that we're talking about here depicts a great conqueror facing down the high priest of Jerusalem and losing. The conqueror is probably Alexander the Great, and this is showing that even the greatest Greek king acknowledged the greatness of the God of Israel.
Yeah.
So,
and that is interesting because it's likely a legend in the Jewish community, and the showdown never actually happened in real life, at least not that we have evidence for. So that's sort of the puzzling piece of it, is because they put so much work and effort into this mosaic to show something that's more of a legend rather than a reality. But that's what you do when you're trying to display greatness, right?
Yeah. They may also have seen the changes happening with the increase in Christianity around them and used the mosaics as a way to show how strong the Israelites were in the past.
Yeah.
So kind of a history lesson, which makes a lot of sense.
Linking
actually
back to your strength in the past. Yeah, for sure.
Yep. This masterpiece, along with the rest of the mosaic panels, were probably laid down by specialists from a local family-owned workshop, because this is a very specialized activity.
It is, for sure.
An inscription by the main door lists several names of people identified as artisans, and they could be the ones who created the floor.
Yeah.
And I don't see why they wouldn't be.
Yeah.
At least designed the floor.
Yeah, probably. What I was reading about the way mosaics were constructed is the masters of the craft would have been the ones that were doing like the figures and like their hands and their faces and all that small, tiny detail stuff. And then anytime there's a huge chunk of one color, they would have their apprentices and people who were still learning, younger members of the family, probably if it was a family business, would be doing that. But just doing that larger section in one color was still like a learning experience for them. Yeah. So that was sort of the like apprentice process for, you know, building mosaics.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not only were these pretty much fancy and over the top, the entire building would have been painted in bright colors, they think. And the archaeologists actually nicknamed this the Disco Synagogue because of the colors, which is kind of funny.
That's funny.
And apparently other towns in the area also had synagogues, of course, and they were all pretty spectacular, which they're sort of interpreting as an inter-Jewish competition in the region. Just like, my synagogue's nicer than yours. I'm not sure I agree with that, to be honest with you.
It was, yeah.
That seems like kind of goes against what the Jewish religion would highlight.
Know. I don't know about that necessarily.
I don't know. Back then, anyway.
Yeah, it might have been a little bit of a competition between Jewish people, but it could have been more just a, hey, Christians, we're here, we have money, and this is what we can build. So
yeah.
It does seem like that is more likely, but I like building a huge building like this, I think would be something that Jewish people would do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the synagogue was used for several generations before it was abandoned, and they think it was because of earthquake damage.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's pretty cool. Hey, I got a little side note here too, because we were watching the Apple TV show Franklin with, is it Michael Douglas?
Michael Douglas.
And we were watching that, and I was curious to see how many Benjamin Franklin's descendants were still alive today. And while I did find that there's apparently lots of them, because he had one illegitimate son who didn't really do much as far as reproduction goes. And then he had another son who died really young, actually. Mm-hmm. And then his daughter actually had like 8 kids, and all of them had many kids.
Yeah.
So from his daughter, there's like lots of Franklins. But when I was looking that up, I saw something about Alexander the Great, and apparently somebody had asked also, are there descendants of Alexander the Great? And apparently there's theoretically none, unless he slept around and there's illegitimate kids, because his wife and kids, when he died, were slaughtered. So there wouldn't be any descendants.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know the full story around that, but that's what I saw. So they say there's no legitimate descendants of Alexander the Great. But
crazy.
I mean, come on. He probably has some illegitimate descendants.
Maybe not. He was only, 32 when he died or something like that?
But still, he went around the world, at least that part of the world.
He did.
You know.
That powerful of a person.
Yeah.
Know, yeah. Could do what they wanted. Well, we did mention this in the beginning, but we do have a bit of a theme with our news articles this week. They're all kind of like art-focused, arty, sort of, depending on your perspective on what it is that they're creating. So, Yeah. We're going to move on to everybody's favorite city in the next segment.
Pompeii. It's going to be a blast. Back in a minute.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours, like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more, made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the Archaeology Show. Almost forgot what it was called there for a second.
Forgot which podcast you're doing because you have so many.
I know. So this is episode 261 and we are continuing our art theme and we're back in Pompeii here. Pompeii has...
It's just everywhere.
They keep excavating.
They do.
They keep finding more and more things and they keep excavating Herculaneum as well and some of the surrounding areas. I actually just saw an article this morning about Herculaneum and a scroll that they were able to read. And
oh, really?
Yeah, they're using some brand new techniques. I can't remember what it was to read these scrolls. And one of them might dictate the actual burial site of Plato, which they knew he was buried in this like Roman cemetery somewhere up in Rome, I think it was. But they weren't exactly sure where.
Yeah.
But this actually kind of gives a little more detail and they might have nailed it. So anyway,
really cool.
The more they find of it, because Herculaneum was kind of a posh little suburb of, you know, Pompeii. It wasn't a suburb. It is now. But
It was where the rich people lived?
Kind of. I mean, not that people weren't rich in Pompeii, but it was like a nice neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah. Pompeii had his, you know, seedy underbelly and stuff going on. So, yeah.
So.
And just as like a quick disclaimer, because I honestly avoided this article when we were looking for them, right?
Just because it's Pompeii?
I mean, a little bit because like
Stonehenge?
We talk about Pompeii so much. I mean, a little bit. Yeah, that one too. Like, because, you know, we talk about these things so much and sometimes it's like, it's too much. We need to learn about other parts of the world. But I was reading one article about this and somebody in the article, I can't remember which one it was. It's not this one. It was a different one. But they said Pompeii is the gift that just keeps giving to archaeologists, not to the people who were in Pompeii, obviously. Well, and
it just gave the one time.
It did. Yeah. And I guess I kind of just have to embrace and appreciate that because it's true. Like the preservation here is just, it's spectacular. And there's nowhere else that has this kind of preservation anywhere. So it's amazing.
Well, what we're going to talk about today was an excavation that was done in a room they called the Black Room because the walls are completely black, except for two amazing frescoes that were found. And this is in a private residence, they think. So,
and they speculate that the dark color on the walls was to hide the smoke deposits from lamps used at night. So they're thinking that this was like an entertaining room kind of a thing where people would have been hanging out in when it was dark out. And
I mean, didn't they hang out in other places when it was dark out? Is that based on evidence, I wonder? Anyway, I just don't know what this is based on, because you'd think they would... I've never heard of a black room before.
I haven't either.
And you'd think every house would have a black room.
I think that this is all speculation, honestly, because they just don't know.
Right.
But their idea is that the flickering lights would have made these two stunning frescoes really come to life against the black background of the walls.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the other thing here, if you look at the picture, it almost looks like it's like a concrete floor that's cracking a little bit.
Yeah.
No. That is a completely white mosaic tile floor. It's got millions of individual tiles. I'm sure it's nothing compared to the one in the last segment. But, I mean, the whole thing is white. So we've got black walls, white floors. I'm sure the reflections and the color would have just been amazing. Yeah. So, yeah. Now on to the frescoes.
Yeah. In the first one, the god Apollo was seen trying to seduce the Trojan priestess Cassandra. Her rejection of him, according to legend, resulted in her prophecies being ignored. So,
yeah. And you might wonder what those prophecies are, or maybe you don't, because
I don't know.
I bet a lot of people actually know. But
well, maybe.
The tragic consequence of her rejection are told in the second fresco, which is when Prince Paris meets the beautiful Helen. And a union, which Cassandra knows will doom them all, occurs, and that results in the Trojan War.
Yep.
So it's basically depicting the beginning of the Trojan War. That's what these two frescoes are.
Yep. And as we mentioned, the Black Room is located in a private residence in a wide residential and commercial block known as Region 9.
Yeah.
And that's what they called it in early Pompeii, was Region 9,
yeah.
Block 62.
I mean, I know Region 9 is not exactly like a great Roman name, but you know, archaeologists have to give methodical scientific names to things so that they can keep them separated.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
yeah,
everything's mapped out.
Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah. So the staff removed several meters of pumice and ash from Vesuvius, and as they are uncovering these lost treasures, they have to also move quickly to preserve them. And this is especially important in this particular room because they found these stunning frescoes that they don't want to lose. Yeah. Right.
Well, and they can't really move them either. So
exactly.
They put everything else in safe storerooms, but these have to be preserved in place.
Yeah. And they do that. And I thought this was so cool. I actually wish there's a little bit more information on how this works exactly in the article, but apparently they inject a plaster glue into the rear of the frescoes to prevent them from coming away from the walls. And I don't know, yeah, if they're on the other side of the wall doing that, or if they...
Those walls are really thick. I'm willing to bet that they've got like a really fine needle syringe type of thing, and it's a very small amount of glue.
Okay.
And they're just getting in behind there. And
just, yeah, getting little bits in.
It's probably very meticulous work, but
yeah,
just enough to basically adhere it, because if it starts to dry out, those tiles are just going to start falling away from the wall.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah. The preservation techniques that they have to use at Pompeii must be like just so much different than other places, because it's so complete. You just don't get preservation like that. So you don't have to worry about, you know, conservation really. So
And Italian OSHA requires them to shore it up with masonry. And they shore up the masonry with scaffolding, and then they put roofing over the top of the frescoes. Basically, again, all to just protect everything.
Protect it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was protected by those many, many feet of ash and pumice before, but now it's just exposed to the air. So
yeah.
Now, this structure itself is interesting and a bit of a mystery. I'm not sure it's too much of a mystery, honestly. Those were the words from the article.
Yeah.
And a little bit disturbing. So let's talk about why.
The structure is comprised of three main areas. One is a laundry that was uncovered in the 19th century. Then more recent excavations uncovered a wholesale bakery. Wholesale? How do we know it was wholesale?
We talked about this in an article from a couple months ago, and they know it was wholesale or commercial because of the size of the ovens the size of like the supplies and stuff that they had there. So they're pretty sure that it was like a place where they were selling bread out of
it.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, now I want bread. Anyway, that was next to the laundry, and behind both of these commercial businesses, a grand residence that contains the Black Room was existing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've kind of got businesses on one side and then residents on the other side.
Well, and if you've ever seen pictures of Pompeii, better yet, if you've ever been there, I've been there twice, and we went there actually not too long ago.
Almost 10 years now, but yeah.
Jeez, was it that long?
Yeah.
Anyway.
15 or 16.
Something like that. If you look there, it's a very dense city.
Yeah.
Like it's not all spread out. I mean, there are some areas that have some courtyards and things like that, but the buildings and all things, everything shares a wall.
Yeah.
It's a very dense city.
Yeah, for sure. And in this case, the excavation team is very confident that all three of these separate spaces can be connected both physically through the plumbing and stuff that they have in the walls, but also in terms of ownership, because there are numerous inscriptions with the initials ARV found throughout all three of them.
Wow.
And that's in like the masonry and stuff, like on bricks and things that are underneath the walls that wouldn't have been exposed day to day, but was there in the foundations or whatever.
Now, unlike other archaeological sites, we have a lot of information about Pompeii.
Yeah.
And we pretty much know who ARV is. And his name was Aulus Rustius Verus.
Yes.
He's a super rich politician in Pompeii that is known from other political propaganda in the city.
Yeah.
And he was the apparent owner of the residence and the businesses.
Yep. And it's also clear, and this is so cool, because this is what I love about Pompeii, is the snapshot aspect of it.
Yeah.
And these structures were clearly under construction at the time that they were buried.
Yeah.
And they know this because they've uncovered these neat stacks of roof tiles, filled pots of lime mortar that would have been used to place the tiles, I believe, pickaxes, and even like a cone-shaped lead weight from a plumb line.
Yeah.
So all the kinds of things you would need to do in a building situation. So very cool.
There's even still a piece of string attached to the plumb weight.
I know, which isn't is pretty that cool?
Now, if you're not really sure what a plumb weight is, it's basically just literally a weight you hang from a line to make a straight line.
Yeah.
Because gravity will hang it straight down from a point wherever you're holding that, and you can make a dead straight line to the ground by doing that. And this was 2,000 years ago. I mean, almost 2,000 years ago, actually a little more than. And the fact that they knew that then, obviously, they knew it well before then. The Egyptians knew that kind of technology. It just reminds me of a reel I saw recently on YouTube, like a YouTube short.
Yeah.
Some guy was looking at this pot from, I want to say it was about 2,000 years old, and it was made from a single piece of stone that was hewed out from the inside. And he was saying how it was basically perfect, like from a diameter, I guess a length and a width kind of perspective, just you could spin this pot on it, and they showed it spinning. And it would spin basically perfectly because it was less
like
than,
a top, basically.
It was like 4.334 or something like that inches across.
Yeah.
And the other direction as well. And it was only off by 1/10,000th of an inch.
Wow.
And people say this was just made without any sort of modern tools or anything like that. I'm like, yeah, it was.
Yeah.
They're actually pretty good. That's what masterful artisans and craftspeople do, is they just do this for their entire lives, and it's all they do, and they're going to get good at it.
Yeah.
You know?
But they probably did have tools in some cases to help them.
I'm not saying they don't.
Yeah.
But they used tools, and they knew how to use those tools. They invented the right tools, and they knew what they were
and
doing.
They knew how to do it. Yeah.
So I also am surprised they said this was probably under construction, because Pompeii was well underway at this point. And unless it was like on the fringes of what's now the city now, which I'm not sure exactly where it was located, I imagine it was more under remodel.
Yes, that's what they're
remodel?
Saying.
It was under remodel.
Remodel.
So while it was being remodeled, they were staying at the Ramada, and that was terrible.
You're ridiculous.
I know.
No, they are saying that it was being
okay.
remodeled or renoed, as the case may be, because I believe that the construction equipment was only found in the residence part of it, not the commercial areas. So that's why they're thinking that Mr. Rich, right? Like he's got to have his upgrade every so often, stay with the times, that kind of thing. So
in the house, they recovered and reconstructed a brightly covered and beautifully crafted ceiling fresco that was smashed during the eruption. So it probably just crashed down.
Yeah, probably. And again, it's freaking gorgeous. If you look at the pictures in the article, I mean, it was created by a master for sure.
The whole thing wasn't super nice, though. The people who were found in what they think were slave quarters, actually found in the bakery, were pretty appalling. The conditions there.
Yeah, they definitely were. And it's kind of showing that like contrast in life, daily life in Pompeii. You've got super rich and opulent on one side of the wall. And on the other side of the wall, we had slave quarters in the bakery area. It's obvious that the people who lived there were kept locked away. They were living side by side with the donkeys that would have turned the millstone in the room. And there was only one window in the room that was clearly the slave quarters, and it had bars on it to prevent escape. So like it's not just slavery, it's like imprisonment almost, right? So just terrible conditions.
And ultimate imprisonment too, because this is the only room where remains have been found, indicating, well, and the remains were skeletons of an adult and two children that were crushed by falling stones. So they didn't leave. They were there when the eruption happened.
They
and
likely were trapped in this
fear.
Room. Yeah. Or they could have been afraid of the owner of the building, so they didn't want to like make him mad, so they just stayed. Who knows? But either way, their bodies are found in one of the rooms.
Now, let's be clear. We don't know they were slaves.
No, we don't know
that. The assumption is being made that they were slaves because a lot of people got out.
Yeah.
I mean, to be honest. And where they were, how they were found, the assumption is just made that they were probably slaves, or in one way, shape, or form, were being you know, held there or couldn't get out or, you know, didn't know where to go.
Yeah.
You know, everybody else took off and left him there. So,
That does seem like the logical conclusion. But of course, you have to be careful with that because you don't know for sure. I'm not sure if they've done any analysis on the skeletons yet to know exactly like where they were from.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Because you can do some pretty, pretty good analysis these days, depending on what the remains look like and the preservation is. So,
Yeah. Well, what they should have done was just, you know, got high and started singing like the people in Peru did. And then they actually did carvings about it.
I don't even know how you're connecting that to Pompeii, but
I'm just saying the whole place is
just
burning.
Just get high? Is that what you're saying?
The whole place is just like falling in. They may as well have just said, you know what? Screw it. Uh-huh. Let's just light this up.
Got it.
Yeah.
Done.
I've been saving this for just such an occasion. Yeah. Don't do drugs. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 261, and we are headed over to Peru, and an article that was published in the Cambridge Archaeological Journal, and we have linked also to the Newsweek article in our show notes.
Yeah, I did the usual thing of, like, I read the Newsweek article, and I was like, this is really cool, and then they linked to the Cambridge Archaeological Journal article, so good for them. And I read the abstract and I was like, this is very jargony and very written for other archaeologists. So I thought the Newsweek article did a really good job of reporting on it. So, that's all you really need.
So the journal article was not titled this. The Newsweek article was.
Yes.
But the title was Carvings in Southern Peru May Have Been Inspired by People Singing While Hallucinating. Which seems to, I guess, fit with other things I've heard about Peru at the time.
But it also seems like a stretch, and we'll get to why. Yeah. But the carvings are located at Toro Muerto in a desert gorge called the Majes River Valley that is located in southern Peru.
Is Toro like bull?
Yes, it is.
So is this like the death bull?
Yes, if you read the next notes.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead and read that one.
I read this like a week ago and forgot. Yeah. Toro Muerto translates to dead bull.
You are learning Spanish. I'm so proud of you.
I did that without reading, like literally a half an inch down.
You did. Yeah, so good job.
I know. It's a rock art complex spanning 10 square kilometers.
Yes.
That's
huge.
Big.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're approximately 2,600 volcanic boulders adorned with petroglyphs. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
I've seen more, but that's a lot.
Have you?
China Lake.
More,
there's
really?
There's over 50,000 in China Lake.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in California.
In an area of a comparable size or bigger? Sorry,
way
this is
smaller.
A tangent, but...
Yeah, it's like it's like a gorge that's a half mile to a mile long, like a drainage kind of thing, but where water really rushes down because it's narrow.
Okay.
And there's 50,000 plus panels.
And you can only get there if you're... in the Navy or with the Navy.
No, you can visit there.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you've got a petition for it.
We should have Alan on to talk about that at some point. But anyway, okay, we digress.
Check out the Rock Art podcast.
Yeah, he's talked about it like kind of a lot there.
Yeah.
So the petroglyphs range from small single motifs to massive panels with many images.
Yeah, a motif is basically an image on a petroglyph panel.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the motifs are, I guess, themed, right? Where you might have squiggly lines and you've got spirals and other stuff like that.
Yeah.
But generally, they're a single concept mixed with other things, you know, a lot of times.
And the people who carved these artworks are thought to have been part of the Wari culture, which existed between 500 and 1000 CE.
Yeah.
So not like the oldest of petroglyphs, but definitely, you know, prehistoric. And they don't explain how they know that. They must have some kind of... some other context that they can use for dating somehow. Yeah. They don't really explain that in the article.
Yep. This new study conducted an analysis of danzantes, or dancing human figures, that appear on many of the boulders.
And I love that word.
I know, right? And the researchers suggest that most of the petroglyphs appear to have been thought out or planned prior to carving. Now, that is a pretty
big assumption. It's a bit of
assumption.
A reach, right?
Now, if you got a bunch of images that look like they're depicting a scene, that I get. But I don't know. I'm not sure where they're really coming to that conclusion.
I think that it's because their coloring and then the uniform spacing kind of... make it seem like the artists knew where they were, what they were going to do before they did it.
Yeah.
They could just be fitting things the way they fit too. So it's hard to say.
Yeah. I mean, it's not uncommon too for a group of people, or, you know, and we always say ritual, but a lot of times rock art is based in rituals. So some sort of shamanistic behavior where somebody comes back to something periodically and adds something to the scene, basically, right? It didn't have to all be done at one time.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but maybe it was. I don't know.
It's hard to say. Yeah. I mean, there's so many here, but you could imagine one panel being done at the same time. It's the whole area would be a lot of work, honestly, to be done at the same time. So,
And around these figures, the danzantes, they also noted similar themes like surrounding them, like zigzags, squiggly lines, dots, and sometimes circles, which are pretty common rock art elements.
Yeah.
They're easy to make.
If you look at the pictures, you'll see they are kind of outside the figures, sort of around the edges. And they are saying that this represents the energy and movement associated with wild dancing.
You see this with other rock art, too. In fact, Alan and I on the Rock Art Podcast just talked about this not that long ago with some of the Coso rock art down in central Southern California, really central Eastern California. And you see these like lightning bolts irradiating out from somebody, indicating energy and excitement and, you know, that kind of thing. So
it does seem like that's legit. And they have some more recent like drawings from people in the that are part of the culture of the area where they use those kind of lines also. So kind of I like how they're kind of bringing in the modern native drawings and the way they depict things and sort of comparing it with this from, you know, 500 or 1,000 years ago and saying, noting the similarities. So I think that does give it some validity, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, these carvings are similar to those done by the Tucano in Colombia, apparently. And I can imagine, I feel like I've seen something like these when you look at the pictures in sometimes in places in this country, too, in the United States. So,
yeah. And the reason that is significant is because prior research shows that the ones in Colombia were done by people consuming the hallucinogen ayahuasca.
Yeah.
So that is where the drug bit comes into this. This sort of wild energy, wild movement that is being depicted in the rock art is potentially to represent people who are consuming a drug like ayahuasca or something similar to that.
Yeah.
And I mean, again, it makes sense. I hate to bring the big R word in ritual.
Religion?
But
oh, yeah, sorry.
Yeah. Kind of the same thing.
I know.
Right? So, I mean, yeah, like it's entirely possible. They don't get to go into how they know that the carvings in Colombia were done by people on ayahuasca.
It's probably drawn on the rock.
Maybe.
It's a plant.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's a slightly more modern version. So they have some actual Spanish recordings or something like that of
It's pretty common for, again, shamanistic type people and others really trying to gain some sort of understanding or something like that to go into a hallucinogenic state using plants and plant-based drugs.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not uncommon. And there's there's cultures that do it today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's called Berkeley. No. Anyway, but that's totally true. So, and the fact that they decided to immortalize this on rock art, or at least depict a certain time that it happened, that's the thing that gets me about rock art is, okay, why did they do it like this one time? Why wasn't it a lot of times? Was it not part of the ritual? Did somebody be like, we need to write this down so we don't forget what happens here and then do that? Was it a cautionary tale? Was it instructional? Was
the why of it is so hard to...
We never know that about rock
art. Yeah, it's almost impossible to know.
Yeah.
If you don't do anything else, click on the link to the Newsweek article and look at the comparison between the boulder that has one of these big panels on it. And then the kind of like, it's not like a photo of it. It's like they took a photo and traced out all the different rock art in black and white. So you can really see the actual images, but you can see all these wavy lines, the dots, the circles and stuff like that. And it's, you can see how it might be indicating either dancing or singing. And it's wild and crazy, so I guess maybe they were doing it on drugs. I don't know.
I guess
it's
so.
It's possible. There's no proof for it, but it does seem like it's definitely a possibility. Kind of cool.
All right, well, the drugs I poured into this wine glass are gone now, so I need to...
is wine a drug now?
I mean, it really is, kind of.
My drug of choice.
If I had too much, it would definitely cause hallucinations.
Wild dancing?
And wild dancing.
Wild dancing!
Wait, no, not that.
Yeah. I really hope it causes wild dancing.
Wow. You better not draw it on the walls of the RV.
Oh, I just might. Watch out.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, well, that's it. We'll see you next time.
Bye!
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.